You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Recently, the head of the FBI, James Comey, was strongly criticized by congressional Democrats for the way that he handled the investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Nearly everything about that story was surprising, but one of the more unusual parts was the very fact that members of Congress were criticizing the FBI. Most of the FBI's work comes under very little scrutiny, and only recently reports reveal its greatly expanded surveillance powers and the lengths the agency has gone to keep their methods secret. Cora Currier, a journalist at The Intercept, and Trevor Aronson, the executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting and a contributing writer at The Intercept, are with us now to talk about their publication's latest series, The FBI Secret Rules, and very pleased they could join us. Welcome to our show.
Thank you so much for having us.
Trevor, isn't there some tension between the FBI's two missions, to enforce the law and to collect intelligence?
Yeah, I mean, especially since 9/11, there has been this tension between kind of the old FBI, which was the organization that more traditionally we thought of as investigating, you know, public corruption and financial corruption and Wall Street, to the organization that today is, you know, charged with stopping the next attack and becoming more of an intelligence agency. And, you know, this kind of bifurcated mission kind of presents some tension within the FBI of agents who kind of want to stay closer to being the criminal investigations agency, and others who would like to see the expansion of intelligence powers. And, you know, what the documents that Cora and I and The Intercept wrote about really kind of reveal the playbook and show very clearly kind of the extraordinary powers that the FBI in the last 15 years has been able to get in the name of, you know, intelligence and counterterrorism, and their ability really to investigate just about any American without much oversight from the court or from the Congress.
Does it vary from office to office?
Well, of course, there are certain offices have a greater amount demand to look at counterterrorism, right? So, like larger cities like New York and Washington and Miami, you see a very large counterterrorism and intelligence division, and in smaller communities there would be less of that. But really, this is kind of a nationwide mandate on the FBI to gather intelligence, to recruit informants, to do whatever they need to do to be on the lookout for the next attack.
Cora, broadly speaking, who governs the FBI? Who gets to regulate it, and who's responsible for its oversight?
So there's actually never been a single statute that gives the FBI its mandate, and by and large, the FBI has been governed by a series of attorney general guidelines, where the attorney general sets out the bounds of what the FBI is allowed to do. And this came into these were particularly codified after the scandals of the 1950s, 60s COINTELPRO programs under J. Edgar Hoover were revealed in a Senate investigation, the famous Church Committee. Then in 1978, the first set of these attorney general guidelines were put out, sort of cabining what the FBI was allowed to do, explaining exactly what the constitutional restraints on their activities were. And in those early guidelines, very closely tying all of their investigative activity to actual crimes, right, to the investigation of actual crimes. And what you saw over the years, beginning before 9/11, but really, really codified after 9/11, was a loosening of that standard, so that FBI activity no longer had to be so tightly tied to an actual, whether it was actual evidence of a crime, but could be used for intelligence gathering and to look proactively into threats. And that's really what we've seen, particularly since in these guides that we obtained date from recent years, and they really all draw on a 2008 set of guidelines from the last year of the Bush administration, which set a very different standard for how, what kind of evidence the FBI needed in order to collect and retain information. And they explicitly made the FBI's mission to obtain and share intelligence and retain it in order to look for intelligence clues.
So the FBI shrunk in the post-Hoover years and then started growing again. How big is it now?
I'll defer to Trevor.
Today there are 35,000 FBI agents and 15,000 informants. And, you know, informants have always been the backbone of the FBI's intelligence work, you know, long before 9/11. But, you know, just to give you some perspective, you know, if you look at the ranks of informants, during COINTELPRO and J. Edgar Hoover, there were 1,500 informants. During the drug wars of the 1980s, there were 6,000 informants. And then after 9/11, following a presidential directive from George W. Bush to expand the ranks of informants, you know, those numbers ballooned to 15,000. You know, as we mentioned on our story, there are so many informants working for the FBI today that they actually have a custom-made software program called Delta that is used to kind of manage and track the informants around the country.
Who would make a good target to be an FBI informant?
It could be anyone, right? It could be you. It could be your neighbor.
I'm telling you right now, I am not an FBI informant. Put that on the public record.
So to make that clear, yes.
I know they've been targeting journalists, so maybe I should make that clear.
To be more specific, I mean, obviously they, you know, in a traditional sense, they would look to recruit informants who were related to the thing that they were investigating, right? So if, you know, traditionally speaking, if they were investigating Wall Street fraud, they'd be looking to recruit a young trader who might be able to provide information about a particular firm. That's in the general criminal context. Now what we see more is a kind of an intelligence context, and, you know, a large target for the FBI in trying to find information about potential threats is to recruit informants from within Muslim communities. And so certainly for the last 15 years, we've seen an enormous emphasis on the FBI to recruit from Muslim communities and using things like immigration as leverage to get otherwise unwilling people to act as informants or provide information to the FBI.
But just Muslim communities, not all so-called alt-right communities?
It could be the alt-right, too. You know, I mean, I don't want to make it seem like the FBI is only focusing on Muslim communities. I mean, you know, certainly there has been a greater emphasis on investigating Muslim communities in a counterterrorism perspective than any other. And so there has been a disproportionate number of informants and investigations involving Muslims for counterterrorism than there have for other groups. But, you know, that said, the FBI does continue to investigate all groups, including white supremacist groups and various other kind of potential threats to national security.
And when they're recruiting informants, do they have to identify themselves as being with the FBI?
So they have and this is what's part of what's revealed in the documents that we looked at. They have what's called a covert approach, and it's not limited to any contact. You know, some assessments or investigations prior to getting a warrant, you know, limit the number of contacts that an FBI agent can have undercover. When they're recruiting informants, they aren't limited to that. And what we found is that agents will use an undercover capacity to recruit informants, and when they're recruited, they'll then pass them over to an agent who's not undercover, and never revealing that the first agent was actually undercover. You know, and this is the type of activity I think we often associate with, you know, NSA and CIA work overseas. But, you know, this is also something that these documents reveal is happening with the FBI, that, you know, undercover agents are in communities actively recruiting people who could be informants for the FBI.
I'm speaking with Trevor Aronson and Cora Currier, who are contributors to a series of articles for The Intercept under the heading The FBI's Secret Rules. Cora, can you tell us a little about the Domestic Investigations and Operations Guide, or the DIOG?
Yeah. So this book is the DIOG, as it's called in FBI lingo, is basically the manual. It's the rule book. It's the Bible for day-to-day operations at the FBI. It covers everything from, you know, how to read Miranda rights to, you know, which form to fill out when you are closing an investigation. And this was a book that the FBI has made public in redacted form previously, older editions of it. But there was a lot that was under the redactions. And so what we did was spend a lot of time going through looking at what had been redacted, what had been withheld.
And what did you find?
Some of what we found were, inconsistent redactions, things that really didn't make sense. It would be redacted in one place, not redacted in another. And I think there was, it was definitely illustrative of a general trend towards, tending towards secrecy, right? Covering up things that really were, kind of bureaucratic designations or things that genuinely we thought the public should know. A couple of interesting things that we found were about the powers that the FBI has in what's known as an assessment, which is the lowest level of investigation. It's not even really right to call it an investigation. It's the FBI looking into, just a general tip or lead or something that is of intelligence interest. They don't need any, particularly factual basis to open this. And, what the dialogue showed is that as part of those investigations, they can actually surveil people with a plane. They can, the particular rules that were needed, the sign-offs that were needed if they wanted to send an informant into a political group, into a church group, or even an FBI employee into a political group, a church group, a business. What kind of sign-offs were needed for those types of undercover operations? And, we thought that those were particularly interesting because this has been an area, the infiltration, particularly of sensitive groups, of academic context, of religious context, where there's been a lot of controversy when, whenever it's revealed that there was an FBI informant in a mosque or that the FBI is looking into anti-war protesters. These are recent examples from recent years. People haven't been able to point to exactly, okay, well, when is that allowed and what circumstances is that okay? And that's what these documents go into great detail of, what kind of sign-off is needed. And what we found was that there were often loopholes. There were often ways that, they could get around the supervisory requirements, or it was just a single supervisor's requirement that was needed. And I think that gets to something Trevor was mentioning earlier about, the difference between you'll have, big headquarters and focused operations and things that are handled out of the big offices. But then you also have the field offices. And, if they're looking into a particular area and you only need one supervisor's approval, there's a lot of flexibility in what they can do in these investigations.
And you mentioned some of the controversial groups' investigations, Catholic workers, Greenpeace, PETA.
Yeah, these were from, early in the Bush administration, and these are things that were revealed and, that were investigated by the Inspector General of the Justice Department years ago. More recently, it was found that the FBI agents were improperly looking into pipeline protesters, people protesting the Keystone pipeline. And, in those cases, they were, reprimanded or whatever, but it took time. And, in the interim, people who were exercising their First Amendment rights to protest and to gather had been surveilled and had their data gathered. And I think something that's also underlined in these documents is that we're in a new era of data retention. The FBI has databases and ways to analyze the information that they collect that are so much more powerful, so much more massive than you ever had when you had, paper filing cabinets. That, it can have pretty serious consequences if someone, ends up in these files, for the rest of their lives.
Why doesn't the FBI need probable cause to investigate something, a group or a person?
Well, in the case of assessments, they, say that that these are not full investigations, right? So they are limited in the tactics that they can use, and the information that they, they can't, subpoena somebody in these cases. They can't do, they can't tap their phones or look at their emails or anything like that. So they're saying, okay, we have a limited set of tactics that we can use, and it's kind of common sense if someone calls in with a lead and it doesn't sound, very concrete, but we ought to still go check it out. And this gets back to what Trevor was talking about in terms of the FBI's new mission to, act proactively to try to prevent an attack rather than, investigating it after the fact.
I'm speaking with Cora Currier, a journalist at The Intercept, and Trevor Aronson, the executive director of the Florida Center for Investigative Reporting, a contributing writer to The Intercept, talking about a series of articles in The Intercept called The FBI Secret Rules, and we will continue a conversation after this. We're talking about an Intercept series under the heading The FBI Secret Rules with Cora Currier and Trevor Aronson. And Trevor, you write that since the 9/11 attacks, the FBI has at times attempted to avoid oversight by being unresponsive to congressional committees, withholding information, and in some cases, providing misleading information. Can you elaborate on that? And why would they do that? I would think that they would be proud of the fact that they are trying to protect us from terrorist attacks, among other things.
Well, part of this gets obviously at the FBI's new role as an intelligence and counterterrorism agency, and it's belief that, you know, in many ways, if its playbook is released and the types of activities that it participates in are revealed, that make it harder to affect terrorists of tomorrow. And so the FBI has been very guarded in discussing its tactics, including with Congress. And what we see is that there is a real resistance for the FBI to discuss both its tactics and kind of its own failures. For example, a House committee investigated some of the intelligence failures surrounding the Boston Marathon bombings, and, you know, the FBI's original response to them before heading was to say, you know, this is not activity as an excuse for not providing information. And so what we see, you know, especially in the last 15 years, is that there really hasn't been diligent oversight by Congress of the FBI. And when there has been, you know, the FBI has been really resistant in providing information or high-level officials to testify before Congress.
Now, Trevor, our connection here, the line is not very good. We're going to try to reconnect with you. I'm not going to suggest that the FBI has somehow intervened to make you sound a little more garbled than you would like. We'll be back with you in a moment. So let me address these questions to Cora. It's been reported that the FBI is using immigration status as leverage to recruit informants, and that tactic is on the rise. Can they just recruit people who are in the country illegally?
Yeah, one of the things that we dug into in the in one of these guidelines, which was about the confidential, what the FBI calls informants as confidential human sources, and we looked at this manual for about confidential human sources, and there's an entire chapter in this manual on immigration. And this is, you know, it's interesting to see that because, you know, I've done stories on this, Trevor's done stories on this, there's been a lot of you know, allegations where you have someone that says, you know, I was pressured to become an FBI informant. They told me that if I didn't work with them, it could hurt my visa. You know, my visa could be canceled. I could be deported. And, you know, the FBI always says, no, you know, we're not allowed to threaten deportation. We're not allowed to do this. And it would always just be somebody's word, you know, often someone who didn't want to go on the record because they were worried about the consequences, you know, against this institutional denial. And while the documents that we have are fairly carefully worded in the sense that they don't say, you know, no, you can deport somebody when they're no longer useful, they have this entire chapter dedicated to the bureaucracy of handling immigration, of working with DHS and ICE agents and stuff to for example, it says that, you know, if the FBI is working with someone who's, you know, an undocumented immigrant who's in the country, and the FBI has basically obtained a waiver for them, you know, it has alerted the other agencies not to deport them, that they want to work with them. And then when the FBI decides they're no longer useful, it says in the book that they have to help DHS locate that person. So in effect, you know, help to deport them at that point when they're no longer useful.
Trevor, go ahead.
You know, there are instances where they can actually get a waiver for, you know, like actually prevent someone from being deported. And again, you know, the FBI says, you know, we, you know, have to work with DHS. We're not circumventing any processes. But, you know, when in my conversations also with the other side, with immigration workers, you know, they'll say, or people who are working on these joint terror task force with the FBI, you know, they'll say, you know, the immigration officers very much want to, you know, the FBI is kind of the big figure in the room, and they want to work with them, and they want to kind of be accommodating. And it's clear that the FBI's interest in someone takes precedent over, you know, what an immigration officer might do with their papers.
Trevor is back. Trevor, do informants know that they may be deported when they stop working for the FBI?
So I talked to a couple of immigration lawyers related to this story, and what they describe is that the situation that Cora revealed, where they are required to provide an informant who's no longer useful back to ICE for deportation, really runs counter to a lot of what FBI agents are telling would-be informants, which is the FBI kind of positioning itself as the good guy in a situation where someone might be deported. That is to say, they would approach an informant and say, hey, you know, if you work with us, we can really help this ICE situation go away. And that the FBI has been able to get cooperation from people as informants based on that type of relationship. But, you know, what wasn't previously known is that if your situation is that you're having immigration problems and you become an informant, and by the time your usefulness ends, you haven't received legal status in the United States, then the FBI is obliged to go back on their promise to help you from, you know, protect you from ICE and essentially turn you over to face, you know, the immigration system, which may include deportation.
Does the FBI operate internationally?
It's
supposedly a domestic agency. Can it also work with people outside the country?
Yeah, and this is what's really interesting in the documents that we have, which is it shows that the FBI, through what are called legal attachés, and in several dozen countries, the FBI has stationed at U.S. embassies someone an agent who is known as a legal attaché or legat in the FBI parlance. And essentially, this person is supposed to be the liaison between the FBI and law enforcement agencies in the host country, you know, for purposes of sharing intelligence or dealing with crimes that cross borders, for example. But what these documents show is that in addition to those functions, legal attachés in other countries are operating informants that you know, that the host country may not be aware of. That is to say that the guidelines do not require the FBI to tell the host country that they're running informants in their country. And so what this shows is that, you know, the FBI kind of expanding not only into being a domestic intelligence agency, but also to having operatives in other countries providing information and data back to the FBI in the U.S.
And are those informants paid?
They may be, yeah. I mean, you know, informants outside the country as well as inside the country, you know, stand to make a lot of money. And, you know, this is something that we knew anecdotally from various criminal trials when an informant takes the stand and testifies that he's, you know, made tens of thousands, even hundreds of thousands of dollars working for the FBI. But what the documents also reveal is that there's a clear kind of payment ladder in place where FBI informants can earn, you know, $500,000 or more with just requiring higher and higher levels of approval within the FBI for, you know, every additional $100,000 level. And, you know, we kind of mentioned examples in our stories of informants who've made hundreds of thousands. You know, one informant, for example, in a 20-year career, you know, has made $4.9 million,
wow,
according to what he's testified.
Is that, does that come out of the FBI's budget? Is that something that is part of their budget line?
It is part of their budget, but the FBI budget that is made public does not break down and the amount of money from that is paid to informants. For, you know, so for example, you know, the FBI has more than $3 billion to fund its counterterrorism division. You know, certainly part of that money is used to pay informants, but, you know, there's no publicly accessible budget line that shows exactly how much money the FBI is paying informants from that amount.
I'm speaking with Trevor Aronson and Cora Currier about a series in The Intercept called The FBI Secret Rules. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Cora, you also reported that the FBI uses secret orders known as national security letters. What are they, and how does the FBI use them?
Yeah, so national security letters are a type of order that the FBI issues in secret. They don't require a judge's approval. They're sort of like a, you know, they're sort of like a subpoena, but they don't need a judge. They don't need a warrant, and they can get certain kinds of information with them, communications records. So not the content of your phone call, but the person, the numbers that you called, the time that you were connected, and when and where, and, you know, that type of record. Certain analogous records for emails, certain kinds of financial records. And they send them to the company, so they'll send them to AT&T, they'll send them to a financial institution. And, you know, they've been using these for years. They were, you know, there have been a series of very critical inspector general's reports over the years of saying that they were using them too, basically playing too loose with them, that they were asking for things they weren't supposed to ask for. Two things that we learned from these documents. One is that if they want to, there's a type of letter that they can ask for someone's records and also the records of everyone they've been in contact with. So sort of a two-step record. They call this community of interest information or second generation. So they'll ask for, you know, your records and also everyone that you've been in contact with. And this allows them to make a map of things. But they obviously consider this secret sensitive because it's a way they're going to scoop up a huge amount of unrelated information in that process as well. Been controversial.
Isn't the FBI also spying on journalists? I'm assuming because The Intercept is doing this series that you might be targets.
So there, you know, during the Obama administration, there was a crackdown on leaks from inside the White House. You know, we had obviously high profile ones like the Snowden documents and ongoing WikiLeaks and investigation. But, you know, there was also a crackdown on just the kind of like normal day-to-day interaction between officials and journalists. And, you know, there was a lot of attention paid to the chilling effect of this crackdown. So the Obama administration put in place certain rules that were supposed to raise the standards for when the FBI, or when they were allowed to go after journalists, when they were allowed to get journalists' records, et cetera. There was one sort of carve-out that everyone was curious about, which was for national security letters. And what we found in these documents is that the FBI can issue national security letters for journalist information. They just need basically one extra layer of sign-off, an extra lawyer to review the request. And this was concerning because it seems like it's sort of a backdoor around these more protective standards for reporters' information, that the FBI can get rules of who, the records from phone companies, for example, of who a reporter's talking to and when.
Can you reveal how you obtained these documents?
No, we can't.
Many members of Congress have accused FBI Director James Comey of meddling in the election. In your reporting, did you discover anything about that subject?
No, I mean, these documents were largely policy guides, you know, laying out the rules as they're, you know, as they're supposed to be enforced, as, you know, what looks good, you know, they look good on paper. You know, in some places we thought they didn't look good on paper, but you know, these are, official documents and, you know, what the FBI sort of aspires to hold themselves to. You know, I think that what was important and the context both of the, of Comey's statements before the election and also now concerns about how a Donald Trump administration will use domestic surveillance powers is that, you know, these documents, even though, you know, they represent the FBI's attempt to, you know, rein in agents to say, here you have to, you know, here's all this bureaucracy you need to abide by. Here's how we're interpreting our authorities under the Constitution. You know, even though they represent a, rules, there's still a lot of flexibility in them, and they're still really underline the extent to which they have transformed their mission into intelligence gathering, and that, you know, that is concerning when you come into a situation where you're concerned that an administration might want to use domestic intelligence powers against political opponents. And, you know, we don't have any evidence that they're doing that yet, but it's, you know, one of the reasons we wanted to make these rules public was so that if there are questions about any investigations, if there are questions when people are being, you know, questioned or having their information seized by FBI, they would point to these rules and sort of say, okay, was this, you know, is this going according to the letter of your own guidelines?
Trevor, how did people in the FBI you spoke to react when you told them that you had copies of these leaked documents? Did they ask you to restrict what you put in the report?
So we did have conversations with the FBI and got them to respond, you know, to specific questions that we had about the documents, and that's reflected in our story. And with the, you know, we took seriously, you know, the potential that the release of information would result in exposing informants or agents or undercover works to danger, right? That by releasing this, we would be revealing someone's identity. And so we did look very closely at the documents and made limited redactions where we felt that harm could come, you know, from those redactions. You know, obviously, many of these documents, or at least portions of these documents, were marked classified. So, you know, it's fair to say that this is not something the government wanted to have released. But we felt in general, as Cora was saying, that there was an overwhelming public interest in having the bulk of these documents made public.
Didn't the Justice Department seize records from phone lines at the Associated Press and also surveil Fox News reporter James Rosen? What reason did they give for that?
Sorry, go ahead, Cora.
That was part of this controversial crackdown on leaks, and that was what was particularly problematic in that action, and particularly on Rosen, was that Rosen was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in that leak case, which meant that, you know, it was a novel way of looking at a leak to say that the journalist was actually co-conspiring to get classified information out. And, you know, a journalist has never been prosecuted for revealing classified information because of the, you know, First Amendment protections that the press enjoys. And so that was a very sort of dangerous area to wade into, and there was a huge backlash against that. And that's partly what led to, as I was saying, the Holder's, Eric Holder under Obama reining in, at least, you know, putting in place some policy protections against that. We don't know, you know, whether the Trump administration is going to abide by those. They were, you know, self-imposed by the Attorney General. So we don't know, you know, what an Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, will do with those kind of protections.
It's interesting that James Rosen and James Risen of the New York Times both were suspected of being involved in leaks. Maybe it's just dangerous to have a name that sounds like that. Okay, I think Bob probably should end with that joke. Thank you both so much for being on our show. I've been speaking with Cora Currier, who is one of the contributors, along with Trevor Aronson and others, to the Intercept series called The FBI Secret Rules. Thank you so much for being on our show.
Thanks for having
us. Thank you.